apologize for being a bit late. I am, as you've just heard, just started my lab just a year ago now at McMaster University, having come from this environment here at U of T. And I'm also a pediatric neurosurgeon, and I currently split my time 50% clinical and 50% science. So I'm here today to talk to you about the cancer stem cell hypothesis. And I know many of you are very familiar with it already. I'm going to review the contribution that we've made to brain tumor initiating cells in particular. I've had the best guidance because John Dick, who discovered leukemic stem cells, was actually on my PhD committee and still serves as a guide to me for a lot of the work we're doing. But this field is very early on in its work, and very and there's still a lot more development that needs to be done. So I'm very excited to sort of present to you the theory today, and then discuss the interface with mathematics. From meeting Mohammed and Siv, I've certainly learned that there's a whole sort of structure and quality that mathematical analysis of our work could certainly lend, so that we could further develop biological concepts. So we'll review all of that today, and look forward to the discussion afterwards. So this is a CT scan with contrast of a patient who obviously has a very aggressive and very large brain tumor. Brain tumors are among the most aggressive tumors known to mankind, and they occur both, unfortunately, in both the pediatric and the adult population. It's the second most common cause of cancer in children, which is really not well known, and it's the leading cause of cancer mortality in children. In adults, the most common brain tumor is called glioblastoma, and many of you may have seen it in the news recently because Ted Kennedy has been diagnosed with it. This tumor is very, very aggressive and almost uniformly fatal, despite the best possible therapy, which currently consists of surgery, radiation, and chemotherapy. Unfortunately, even with all of the best possible known therapy today, the one-year survival rate is really only around 10%. So clearly, brain tumors are aggressive and refractory to even the best possible therapy. So I'm going to switch gears and tell you a little bit about the properties of a stem cell, and we'll get back to tumors in a minute. I'll make the link as best as I can. For this particular slide, we're going to be focusing on tissue-specific stem cells or somatic stem cells. I'm not talking right now about totipotent embryonic stem cells, but rather stem cells that are specific to a given organ or tissue. And so the properties of a stem cell are, first of all, self-renewal. And self-renewal doesn't imply your typical mitotic division or simply proliferation. It implies a very special type of division, which is most often asymmetric, whereby a stem cell gives rise to a cell that is similar to the original maternal cell, as well as a daughter cell that may be different or may be the same. So the really interesting thing about self-renewal is that we're finding out more and more now that self-renewal is very tightly regulated by intrinsic cell signals, but also highly responsive to extrinsic cell signals from the microenvironment. And in fact, in a lot of cases, the microenvironment, the tissue or organ provides a specific feedback to the stem cell to dictate what type of self-renewal division a cell should perform. And I'll give you some examples. So the three types of self-renewal division are expansion, maintenance, and extinction. And the three different types of division, for example, with extinction, if a stem cell gets extrinsic signals sent to it that the tissue is already large enough or overexpanded, then it will generate two daughter cells that are differentiated or have fully completed their fate decision, and therefore will no longer contribute to the continued growth of the tissue. If a stem cell senses that the tissue or organ needs to be continued to develop, then it will undergo a maintenance self-renewal, in which the stem cell will give rise to another stem cell, and then a more differentiated daughter cell, or a daughter cell that's more mature. And so in this sense, this is the most common type of self-division that stem cells undergo, and in this asymmetric form of self-renewal is specific only to stem cells. The third type of division, which is expansion, occurs when a stem cell gets signals, either intrinsic or extrinsic, that the tissue or organ needs to be further expanded. And in this case, the stem cell will give rise to two daughter stem cells. And so you can see how this very tight intrinsic regulation can somehow be dysregulated to perhaps generate a tissue or organ that can become out of control, and that this actually may be a property that's reminiscent of cancer. So self-renewal is one property that we realize is possessed by both stem cells and may be dysregulated when organs or tissues become tumors. Proliferation is the second feature, and that simply is the more mitotic division that I was mentioning before. Multilineage differentiation simply implies that whatever your end organ or end tissue is, whether it be normal or a tumor, the stem cell must be able to give rise to all of the different types of cells that make up a tumor. And so, for example, with a brain tumor, we have the luxury that scientists of hematopoietic diseases don't have, which is that brain tumors have a luxury of architecture. And we, because we work with solid tissue, we actually are able to see the microenvironment of a tumor in the cytoarchitecture of the cells that make up the tumor. And basically, any type of stem cell, normal and malignant, has to be able to recapitulate or make up all of the cells that generate that end tissue or organ. The last feature is a little bit in dispute. The last feature is longevity. And I think for those of you who already know about the stem cell field, you'll know that there's a lot of semantics in our field and a lot of discussion about definitions and what really is a stem cell and what's a true stem cell and what's not a stem cell. And we spend a lot of our time at conferences debating who works with the more true stem cell. And it can get quite convoluted. But one thing to keep in mind is that part of the purest definition of a stem cell is that a stem cell should be around for the lifetime of an organism, and that a stem cell should be a cell that in some sense may reserve its self-renewal capacity such that it may execute it at any time during the lifespan of the organism. And this is also a more new feature, as I'll talk about later, with respect to the brain. So the thing I want you to note from this slide, of course, is that all of these features are also reminiscent of cancer biology as well. So the very best characterized system for stem cells, of course, is blood. And that's because the hematopoietic people have a good 50 or 60 years of biology, of experiments and beautiful research ahead of all of the solid tumor people and of solid organ people. So this there's a lot of pride in this work, because a lot of this work was actually characterized and done here in Toronto by Till and McCulloch, who back in the 1960s, late 50s and early 60s, first developed the spleen colony forming unit assay and first discovered normal hematopoietic stem cells that existed. And they were then able to advance this into cancer, along with John Vick, who first applied these concepts to develop the notion of the leukemic stem cell. And the nice thing you notice about this is that there's a beautiful hierarchy whereby you have a long-term stem cell that sits at the top, a long-term renewing stem cell that sits at the top of the lineage hierarchy, that then gives rise to various grades of multipotent progenitors that then give rise to lineage-specific progenitors that eventually give rise to all of the final lineages that make up the blood. So here you see all of the different types of T cells, B cells, granulocytes, macrophages that all have different functions and all make up the blood. And this all applies to organ, to solid tissue organs as well. But what's really helped the blood people map this out better? Well, the advent of monoclonal antibody technology and flow cytometric sorting, which happened in the 70s and was greatly advanced by Irving Weissman at Stanford, all of these features contributed to being able to uniquely map the lineage of each of these by cell surface marker expression. And so this allowed you to uniquely identify cells of all of the different lineages. So we get the concept that tissues are organized as a functional hierarchy derived from stem cells. So keep this sort of general idea in mind throughout the talk. This is your stem cell that sits at the top of the hierarchy. It has the capacity of self-renewal, which is unique to stem cells. And it tends to divide slowly. And often, part of the problem of detection of these cells is that, not necessarily empirically, stem cells tend to be quiescent. And the stem cells that are at the very top of a lineage hierarchy tend to be ones that reserve their self-renewal, and they actually have a limited number of self-renewals that they're allowed to execute, and they tend to hold on to them and execute them over a very long span, as opposed to these rapidly proliferating short-term progenitors, which are daughter cells of the stem cells. These progenitors tend to divide extremely rapidly, but they have short-lived bursts of proliferation, and then they tend to senesce or quieten down after a short burst of activity. And then lastly, you have mature cells, which are the differentiated cells that make up all of the cytoarchitecture of a specific organ. So for example, in brain, we have neurons, astrocytes, oligodendrocytes, and ependyma. Those are the different differentiated or mature cell types that make up the brain. And they all have specific functions, mostly supportive, the glial cells, which are the oligos, the astrocytes, and the ependymal cells, all are supportive functions for the neurons, which of course execute our brain activity. But all of these mature cells have different functions ascribed to them. They tend not to proliferate. And this seems like a rather obvious slide now, but even as short a time as 10 to 15 years ago, the dogma was that you were born with a certain number of neural cells and they would not be able to regenerate after birth. And quite simply, you had a certain number of neurons, and as they died over your lifetime, and as you age, you become more and more forgetful and and basically senile. And it's a depressing theory if you think about it. It's one that most of us as we age would rather not think about. And fortunately, it's not true. So all of us in this room have neural stem cells, and they are there over the lifetime of the organism. And back in the 1960s, Robert Altman actually discovered that canaries, in forming all of their various complex songs, actually could generate new stem cells, neural stem cells. And he was the first one to really identify that. And unfortunately, this theory was all but overlooked throughout the 70s and 80s and only rediscovered in the 1990s again, when, again, more Canadians, Sam Weiss and Brent Reynolds, discovered neural stem cells did exist and formed beautiful in vitro colonies, which I'll tell you more about shortly. So we can defy the dogma. So here are some neural stem cells, and here you see this is a mouse subventricular zone stained with one of the only markers we know so far that's specific for neural stem cells are thought to be nestin, and CD133 is one I'll tell you a little bit more about today. And here you can see the developing subependymal zone in an embryo, and here in a human we have the subventricular zone. So here you can see this is a coronal section of the brain, and you can see this is all brain tissue. This is fluid space, the ventricles, where we have our cerebrospinal fluid, and just beneath this zone here is where the neural stem cells reside. Also in the hippocampus we have the subgranular zone, which is another zone where stem cells reside. So if you were to go into a mouse brain and isolate cells from this region, and then go and culture them in serum-free conditions, and with very specific growth factors that I'll tell you about that favor neural stem cell colony formation, you would find that each of these stem cells is capable of forming this one of these beautiful non-adherent floating colonies, which we call a neurosphere. And the reason that this is such a beautiful in vitro assay is because every neurosphere is assumed to be derived from a single stem cell. And so this is a clonal assay. And in our field, we love clonal assays because they permit you to estimate the frequency of stem cells within any given cell population. And this was all discovered by Reynolds and Weiss in 1992. So here's our more rudimentary neural stem cell hierarchy. And you can see why I don't like presenting at blood conferences, because this is much more rudimentary than the more elegant map I showed you before from the blood people. And so here we have a neural stem cell that sits at the top of the hierarchy. It's nestin positive and CD133 positive. And then here's the area where we haven't characterized very much. We really don't know whether this cell gives rise to some more restricted short-term proliferating progenitors, or whether they simply go down, or whether there's a long-term progenitor here and then several short-term progenitors. This area is very gray, and we do not yet have unique marker identification that identifies the long-term and the short-term possible progenitors within neural stem cell populations. But we do know that this stem cell will get extrinsic signals, like the extrinsic signals I was talking to you about before. All of these different growth factors that exist within the brain environment will then favor lineage determination down these different pathways. Neurons have markers that identify them specifically. So do astrocytes, and so do oligodendrocytes. And the very interesting thing is that the neural stem cells, we know not only do they have the capacity to respond to these extrinsic signals, but they also have a very well-defined intrinsic program, and that is simply because any single neural stem cell in a dish will always generate the same proportion of these cells in the proportion that makes up the brain. So, for example, the brain is made up of about 20% neurons, 50% astrocytes, 10% oligos, and then various other cells. And you'll find that a normal neural stem cell will always recapitulate the lineages in those particular proportions. So we know there's both an intrinsic program over which is overlaid all these different extrinsic programs, and there's a certain amount of plasticity whereby a neural stem cell can respond to changes in its in vitro environment However, this is limited. And I'll tell you a little bit more about tumor-initiating cells, where I think that actually their plasticity and their capacity to respond to external signals is actually greater than a normal neural stem cell. And this is just to show you that a single colony, a single sphere, can give rise to all of these differentiated lineages that make up the brain. So just to define better these concepts so that we're not, so that we can sort of define our semantics now, normal stem cells are tightly regulated and they're able to differentiate into normal cells of the tissue. Cancer stem cells can be used in any different context that you want, and I'm sure that we've all attended conferences where they're taken to mean different things. The AACR definition, which was fleshed out by John Dick and a lot of his colleagues, I think is probably the most pertinent one to the work and probably also the most broad definition. But what that simply specifies is a cancer stem cell does not mean that we have found the cell that gives rise to cancer. A cancer stem cell is simply a cell that by virtue of mutations is dysregulated and can self-renew and differentiate aberrantly to generate all of the abnormal cells that make up the cancer, just as a normal neural stem cell can generate all the normal cells that make up a tissue. And so what we're saying is not that we have pinpointed the cell in the hierarchy that leads to the cancer. Rather, what we're saying is that any cell, and I'll elaborate on this a bit more, may somehow have the capacity to go back and adopt this phenotype. Okay, so we'll talk about that a little bit more. So this is not a new idea, and by no means are we the first people to ever have thought of it. This has actually been around for, I think, almost a century, and even dating back to Virchow and more than 150 years ago. But this is a paper from 1944 where these authors have already defined that there's a subependymal plate from which primitive germ cells seem to be forming tumors. And even back then, people noticed that tumors tend to form a lot more often in the subventricular zone than in other places in the brain. And so this really was picked up a long time ago. And what really favors the concept that a brain tumor could arise from a stem cell in which mutations have incurred some kind of dysregulation of the of lineage determination or self-renewal? Well, brain tumors frequently do resemble primitive normal brain cells. And in fact, medulloblastomas, which are one of the most common brain tumors that occur in the posterior fossa and the cerebellum of children, this tumor was thought to arise from a medulloblast. And the medulloblast was defined by pathologists Russell and Rubinstein back in the 60s, where they thought there was a primitive cell that arose from the external granule cell layer in the cerebellum, and that this cell was the origin of the medulloblastoma. And actually, these tumors do resemble proliferating external granule cells of the cerebellum, even on the molecular level, where the sonic hedgehog pathway is thought to be involved in both the normal prototype and the cancer prototype. Secondly, if you get animals and expose them to carcinogens like ENU perinatally, they get tumors of different phenotypes, but they all preferentially arise from the subventricular zone. So even in other animal or mouse models of cancer, we do notice this propensity for location at the subventricular zone. Brain tumor cells do tend to express nestin, which is a primitive stem cell marker, and Eric Holland conducted a beautiful series of oncogene transfer, whereby he found that if you take the most potent oncogenes you can think of, SARC, RAS, anything like that, and you put them into different compartments by virtue of this beautiful avian retrovirus system they developed where they could specifically express these genes in different lineage compartments. What they found is that if you put those genes into a neural stem cell, it's about 20 times more permissive to form cancers than if you put it into a fully differentiated mature cell like an astrocyte or a neuron. So again, why should we think tumors could technically arise from any of these three compartments that I showed you before? What really makes us think that a tumor should arise from a stem cell rather than from a progenitor cell or a mature cell? Well, I'll tell you the two reasons that I think. One is that why is the stem cell more likely a target of transformation? First of all, longevity. If we believe that longevity is a feature of a stem cell, technically these neural stem cells are around for the lifetime of an organism, which allows for the accumulation of genetic mutations over the lifespan of the organism. And I'm sure everyone is aware of different models of cancer whereby carcinogenesis is a step-by-step, mutation-by-mutation accumulation of events over time. And this model seems to stand very well for a cell that's around for a long time. Secondly, a stem cell already possesses all of the machinery required to undertake those special self-renewal divisions I told you about, whereas a completely differentiated cell like a neuron would have to go back, somehow de novo generate all of that machinery, and then behave like a stem cell, so to speak. So in terms of energy saving, motions, it's much more economic for a stem cell to actually be dysregulated and execute all those self-renewals that must occur in cancer. And also came a lot of the work came from the observation that a brain tumor, which on a basic pathological level seems to look like a very homogeneous tumor, actually is heterogeneous. And what you see is that this medulloblastoma actually expresses markers of both a neuronal lineage and an astrocytic lineage. And so the heterogeneity of these tumors is actually fundamental to the concept of the cancer stem cell. So here on this model here, you see that this is a typical model of cancer, is that tumor cells are heterogeneous, but any cell within the tumor could proliferate extensively and form tumors. So this is all a question of frequency, and that's why it's so nice to talk to a room full of mathematicians, is that what we're saying here is that if you take a strong enough oncogenic mutation, any cell in a cancer could actually form a tumor. Whereas the cancer stem cell hypothesis suggests that there's a rare minority of cells within a tumor that actually are more, in which the mutations are more frequently and likely to occur, and only these cells will generate tumors. The rest of the tumor, although it may bear this, signs of transformation, these cells are not capable of exclusively regenerating the tumor. So we wanted to link these ideas of development and brain development that I've talked to you with the concept of brain cancer. And we wanted to try to test, to find a model to test whether brain tumors really do originate from normal neural stem cells, and which cell within a heterogeneous brain tumor population is responsible for maintaining the tumor. And lastly, are brain tumors organized like a hierarchical stem cell system? So a lot of the ideas for this work, again, came from outside of our field, from leukemia, where John Dick established that there are rare human leukemic stem cells that have the ability to recreate the patient's leukemia after they transplanted the cells and the different lineages of cells marked by their specific marker identity into immunodeficient mice. And so we went on and wanted to examine specific populations of cells within brain tumors, and we were able to actually identify a subset of cells within brain tumors of many, many different phenotypes, up to 13 different phenotypes actually, a rare population of cells that behave like stem cells. And I'll tell you a little bit more about those cells now. So here's brain tumors from 12 pathological subtypes. And what we did is we took specimens from the operating room, so specimens of the whole tumor representing the heterogeneity of the whole tumor, brought them into the lab, dissociated them enzymatically, and then cultured them in media that was first used by Reynolds and Weiss that was specific for neural stem cells. So this is serum-free media in which almost 95% of cell lines will not survive without serum. Okay, cells are very dependent on serum in general. Stem cells, however, grow in a serum-free environment supplemented by EGF and FGF, two growth factors that are important in development and help stem cells grow. And in doing so, we were hoping to purify or enrich for stem-like cells in the population. What you find is that a majority of the cells actually plate down and adhere and don't do much of anything. But you have a small population of cells that float and that don't adhere and start to form these clonal colonies. And so what we actually found is that all of these tumors were capable of forming spheres or clonal colonies, which we then called tumor spheres. And what we found is that the clonogenic frequency of these tumor spheres seemed to correlate with the biological aggressiveness of the tumor. And so here you have a very benign tumor, and it had a very low clonogenic frequency, whereas the glioblastoma, that horribly aggressive tumor I told you about at the beginning, would have a very high clonogenic frequency. So we applied all of these different in vitro assays developed by the neural stem cell scientists to brain tumors to qualify the different characteristics of these cells with respect to self-renewal and proliferation and differentiation. But we wanted to find out, is there a better way to identify or purify these populations? And so we went into the literature and we found this cell surface marker called CD133, which at the time was a hematopoietic stem cell marker, which was also expressed in a lot of other embryonic and fetal organs. And other researchers had found that CD133 enriches highly for primary human fetal brain cells with stem cell properties. And so we postulated that CD133 may also enrich for a stem cell population in brain tumors, and that these cells and these cells alone should originate and regenerate the brain tumor. And what we found is, much like the clonogenic frequency The CD133 frequency also reflected the biological aggressiveness of the tumor. And so just like the clonogenic frequency was very low in the very benign tumors and very high in the more malignant tumors. And very surprisingly, what we found is that when we purified these populations using the monoclonal antibody technology and flow cytometry that I told you about, you can use fluorescent activated cell sorting to actually mark different populations and then sort them into purified fractions. And when we did this, we found that all of the self-renewal and clonogenic capacity resided exclusively within the CD133 positive population, whereas those majority of those cells that plated down and just sort of differentiated and formed processes and sat on the bottom of the plate were exclusively negative. And what we then had to prove was that we simply weren't capturing normal neural stem cells that had migrated into the brain tumor. And this is a question that was frequently brought up. We've heard from other publications that normal neural stem cells tend to migrate towards sites of injury within the brain. So just to prove that we haven't just recruited normal neural stem cells and that's what we're seeing in our dish, we showed that the cells that we were studying actually had undergone transformation events and were indeed oncogenic. Or transformed, because here we see this is a spectral karyotype, and instead of seeing the normal chromosome numbers, you see loss of chromosome 16, a gain of chromosome 18, and a loss of 10. And these karyotypic abnormalities are very, very typical for patients with medulloblastomas. And furthermore, very interestingly, both the positive and the negative populations have the same cytogenetic alterations, which further supported the concept that perhaps these self-renewing clonogenic positive cells were undergoing asymmetric division in which they would give rise to a daughter CD133 positive cell as well as a CD133 negative cell. And in fact, the spectral karyotype similarities may suggest there's a clonal origin of these cells. So we further examined, at first we had only specifically looked at pediatric populations because there's a very natural development between thinking of a tumor that arises in a more developmental setting and a brain tumor stem cell theory. But what we actually found is that the brain tumor stem cell is actually also found in adult tumor populations. And here you can see that this limiting dilution, which shows the minimum frequency of cells that are required to form a sphere, is even more aggressive with the adult GBMs than with the pediatric tumors. And here are tumorigenic astrocytes that differentiated from this GBM sphere. So we had carried out all of our in vitro work, and we really had to find a very good animal model in which to test this. And really the gold standard of any scientific test is a biological or in vivo assay. And so we again, modeling ourselves on John Dick, took the Nod-Skid immunodeficient mouse model, and we purified these brain tumor stem cells, as we called them, into positive and negative fractions, and then we performed in vivo serial limiting dilution assays, whereby we tested what the minimum frequency number of positive and negative cells would be required to generate, what was necessary and sufficient to generate a tumor in a mouse model. And so here's a mouse MRI taken at the imaging facility here at SickKids. And you can see here, just in the subventricular zone, there's this enhancing mass. And the question is this a tumor? And so before I show you the results of this positive xenograft, you notice a very small number of cells. I'll show you, first of all, data that no matter how many fold we increase the number of negative cells, we really didn't find many tumors that existed at all in the negative injections. Subsequent papers have found that, of course, negative cells can form tumors, but again, I'll bring it back to the point that I think this is really a question of frequency. And in this paper, which was a proof of principle, we found all the tumors occurred in the positives. There weren't any in the negatives. We had executed only a certain number of injections, and certainly if you do more and more and more, sooner or later, whether it's a result of purity of your populations or the fact that a true negative cell can generate a tumor, that certainly negatives can get tumors, but what we found overall and what seems to be consistent in the literature is that the tumor-forming frequency is much, much higher in the positive population. And what we found furthermore is that the architecture of the xenograft in the mouse highly resembled or almost completely resembled the pathological phenotype of the patient's original tumor. And this is very important simply because a fact that not many tumor researchers acknowledge is that almost all of the GBM cell lines that people typically work with when they, you know, publish papers on cancer, they actually don't resemble the patient tumors. and they don't behave like the tumors when you inject them in, they don't behave like the original GBM tumors when you inject them into mice. And so this actual sort of phenocopy value is very, very important because it's really recapitulating the actual behavior of the original tumor. And furthermore, even with the adult tumors, we saw that the original tumors, that the actual xenografts were actual phenocopies of the original tumor, down to the point where you could apply the WHO definition of all of the pathological features that you require to actually diagnose the GBM. You can apply them to our mouse tumors, and all of those features are there. So we even found, again, interestingly, that when we looked at typical mutations that were very, very characteristic, and that a lot of the key work that was done by genetic researchers in brain cancer, we examined some of these typical mutations and amplifications that have been identified, such as the one for epidermal growth factor receptor, and we found that in the original patient tumor, here we have gains of chromosome 7 and amplification of EGFR, and all of these mutations are shown in our GBM xenografts as well. So in summary, we found that the cell surface marker CD133 could be used not necessarily to completely purify, but to enrich for brain tumor cells that have stem cell properties. These cells showed all of the self-renewal ability of the tumor, both in vitro and all of the tumorigenic ability in vivo. This cell has very potent self-renewal capacity, generating tumors from as few as 100 positive cells. And again, for those who work in the brain cancer field, for a typical cell line, it requires anywhere from 500,000 to a million cells even to get engraftment. So this is a really potent cell that is able to do this in a mouse brain. And the tumor generated by the transplants is a phenocopy of the patient's original tumor. So clinical implications of this are that perhaps the way that we currently analyze tumors, the bulk analysis, may not detect the key molecular alterations that occur in a cancer stem cell. And perhaps if we redirect therapy against the cancer stem cell, tumors will no longer relapse or continue to grow. And so this kind of concept took hold in the brain tumor field. And the clear thing that I want to identify to you, though, is if we come back to the definition of a cancer stem cell, we are certainly not, we are nowhere near proving that cancer arises from a normal neural stem cell. That's really not at all been proven yet. We simply don't know at this point whether tumors arise from a CD133 positive stem cell or whether a completely differentiated cell has the capacity when an oncogenic mutation is introduced to go back to a CD133 positive phenotype. So it's a little bit like the Heisenberg uncertainty principle. Really, we don't know whether we're vacillating between different states, and it's clear to us that cell surface marker expression alone is not going to help us answer that question. So we'll talk a little bit more about that as well. But it does seem that there are many other groups now that have found these populations, and this actually has new therapeutic implications. So what's seen is that I was talking to you a little bit before about how current modalities of treating brain cancers like chemotherapy and radiation aren't successful. They may actually slow the growth of the tumor for a short time, but almost uniformly the patients will die from their disease despite our best possible therapy, and that includes surgery, so I'm not biased. What has been found in the literature is that cancer stem cells from glioblastomas that are CD133 positive are actually radio-resistant and also chemo-resistant. And so it does seem that these stem cells have specific molecular mechanisms by which they can actually become refractory to our therapies and then persist so that the tumor will relapse or regrow. And then these cancer stem cells have now been found in an increasingly long list of different solid tumors. And a lot, you can see here, I've shown the markers that people have used to identify cancer stem cell populations from all of these different solid tumors. And so the cancer stem cell hypothesis is definitely taking root within the solid cancer field as well. We have a lot of work left to do. We have so much work left to do to really bring this whole idea of cancer stem cells to some kind of clinical or therapeutic implication for patients. And although it may seem like a very hot field right now, I still have a lot of caveats in my own mind about the fact that we haven't established some basic biology yet, and we certainly have to take things back to a single cell and clonal level to verify a lot of the findings. So we have a lot of work to do to actually further purify this cell. We have a single marker by which we've enriched the population, but by no means have we fleshed out that beautiful hierarchy I showed you at the beginning that applies to hematopoiesis. So there's a lot more work that needs to be done here. We need to figure out if all the developmental signaling pathways that regulate self-renewal in normal neural stem cells apply also in cancer. We need to do a little bit of this, and there are lots of caveats to this, which I'll tell you about in a minute. There may be a very big role for chromatin remodeling in determining the fate of tumor stem cells, and I have a beautiful story to tell you another day about that. We're hoping that in the future, and even with CD133, we can see that there may be some link to prognosis. And as we accumulate more data and we're able to go back and correlate it to our patient data, and even with some papers that have already shown Kaplan-Meier survival analysis models, it seems that some of these cancer stem cells markers will be linked to prognosis. This is a question that really is the root of everything that no one has yet answered. Just a little side thing to tell you about, and this is probably covered a lot more in other seminars here, so I won't belabor this point at all, but your traditional model of cancer is that cancer occurs in a cell that acquires growth advantages through stepwise accumulations of mutations, and the mutations are typically thought to occur in tumor suppressor genes or in oncogenes, and they're in constant balance and cancer is dysregulated by dysregulation of this balance. However, there's a whole new concept now that we have to overlay onto genetics, and that's epigenetics. And so this introduces another level of complexity to everything we're doing. So you have the cellular and developmental hierarchy, then you have genetics that you have to integrate or overlay, and then you have epigenetics that you have to also overlay now. So epigenetics are heritable changes in gene expression that are not caused by changes in DNA sequence. And this concept is also known as gene silencing. And so without going too much into this, what we're talking about is a form of gene silencing or repression that is actually heritable. And the really key clinical implication to this is that unlike gene mutations, which once they occur, even though we've had a lot of trials with gene therapy, the fact is once you have a genetic mutation, it's hard to go back and reverse that. However, epigenetic changes are actually potentially reversible and can be almost more simply reversible. So basically you have this new concept that is now being applied to cancer in leaps and bounds, where you have states whereby the promoters of certain genes can be regulated by ways that are actually not heritable. So here you see that these are some genes that are involved in cancer that people have recently discovered are actually epigenetic modifiers and not necessarily only working on a genetic level. So here you see genes involved in different types of cancer that are now thought to be regulated in an epigenetic fashion. And actually, these stories are very relevant. Epigenetic stories are extremely relevant to brain tumors. And here I show you two stories recently that are epigenetic stories, one of which has hit the newspapers big time last year, or 2 years ago actually, when two New England Journal studies were published showing that epigenetic silencing of this gene by methylation of the promoter actually allows an agent called temozolomide, a chemotherapeutic agent, to become much more effective in patients with glioblastoma. And so actually a subpopulation of patients who bear this mutation respond so well to temozolomide that they actually have a 5-year survival, which was unheard of before. And actually 26% of patients have a 2-year survival as opposed to about 2 to 6% in the non-mutation bearing population. So we didn't even realize that this drug had an epigenetic mechanism. A lot of times chemotherapeutic agents we use, we're not even sure how they work. But in this case, finding out that there is actually an epigenetic role to this agent has given us a lot more information about a very bad tumor. And here's another tumor, atypical paratoid rhabdoid tumor, which is almost uniformly fatal in children, where we found that there's a gene that's completely, or rather a chromatin remodeling complex that's completely typical only for this tumor and identifies it, such to the point where if you see this, then you can actually make a diagnosis of this tumor. And this is actually an epigenetic story as well, whereby you have a loss of DNA damage repair. So epigenetic stories are becoming increasingly important in the cancer, in the brain cancer field. And epigenetics is also important in cancer stem cells and in stem cells. So actually, there's a lot of papers that have come out recently talking about the concept of fate determination in stem cell populations, both normal and cancer, and that there may be epigenetic regulation mechanisms linked to these stories as well. And so that sort of allows us to develop a model whereby perhaps you have this multipotential brain tumor initiating cell that has an intrinsic program that is capable of being dysregulated on a genetic level, and extrinsic factors that may be dysregulating things either on a on an epigenetic or a signaling related way. And actually, these extrinsic factors make up what we call the stem cell niche. So you have this cell that then somehow goes down a lineage hierarchy that is dysregulated in cancer, such that you may block differentiation down certain pathways and favor the lineage that makes up the actual tumor. And so you have this concept of fate determination, lineage determination, also that may be linked to epigenetics. So this is our institute at McMaster. I work within the Stem Cell and Cancer Research Institute. These are the things we're undertaking right now. I know you have heard so much recently about induced pluripotent cells. We're actually looking at ways of where they've taken fibroblasts from patients, introduced four embryonic stem cell genes, and you get them to turn back into what seem like embryonic stem cells. We're now looking at ways of reprogramming cancer using this type of IPS, and this is being undertaken by all of us here. These are the five scientists that make up the SCCRI, and these are our specific Canada research chairs. And so you can see we have people that specialize in stem cell signaling and epigenetics, and so we in the field of human cancer and human stem cells are collaborating with these other scientists who have great knowledge of the things, other things I've been discussing with you today. And just a little bit of sort of new ideas. So this is since I've started my own lab. These are all the different cell types that we're examining. We're actually looking at tumor spheres from medulloblastomas, from GBMs, but also we've undertaken a new arm of our work whereby we're looking at brain metastases as well. And I've just been talking to Siv and Mohammed about some new ideas about migration and metastasis within our cell populations, which are starting to look very intriguing. So we've been able to purify a population of metastatic or secondary brain tumor cells as well, and we're working on purifying them right now. We're looking at gene expression profiling as well, and I know there are many, many caveats here that I think you've all discussed already, but the problem with microarray and gene chip technology, and I think there's a huge interface now with biologists and mathematicians that needs to be explored, is as a biologist and a physician, I am now able to interrogate my cell populations, and then I'm overwhelmed by a tidal wave of data that will come back at me. And unless it's statistically analyzed in a meaningful way, I think that it's going to lead to a lot of biology that will be, frankly, wrong. And so I think before we leap into these different areas, I think there's a beautiful interface where mathematicians and biologists need to talk is, of course, bioinformatics, and finding out the best structures and modeling systems whereby we should be looking at these systems so that we can bring them to biological relevance. It's simply too easy for people who don't have the mathematical knowledge, such as myself, to look at a long list of 20,000 genes to then, you know, look at the top 400 and figure, okay, which one of these has a relevant biological story? Oh, wait, I'll pick that one. And then you're back down to a single gene approach, which a lot of cancer publications focus on. If you knock out this gene, you get cancer. And we all know it's not that simple. But I think this is really an interface where all of us can work together. But having said that, the thing that's unique about our microarray, I think, is that we've been trying to interrogate not the cells that make up the whole tumor, but because we have this capacity to prospectively sort the tumor into stem cell and non-stem cell fractions, I've been trying to compare through microarray the gene expression profiles of the CD133 positive cells compared to the CD133 negative cells from given tumors. And I was just discussing with Natalia before I started speaking the fact that one of the factors that is really slowing us down and hindering us right now is the whole concept on which the cancer stem cell theory is based, which is heterogeneity. The problem is tumor to tumor, patient to patient, there's a inability to compare even tumors within the same subtype. So a GBM in a 30-year-old patient is not the same as a GBM in a 60-year-old patient. And so the struggle that we have is the individual heterogeneity of tumor to tumor, which makes them almost sample sizes of n equals 1. And it's very hard to even consider pooling data from the tumors of the same subtype. So...
You mean genetically?
Genetically.
Microarray,
even on a microarray basis.
Microarray,
yeah.
You don't. So
you can, but again, it depends on how you're analyzing your data, and it depends on what you're looking for. And what I find is that as biologists, We tend to have such a focused view is what we'll do, and this is really typically how a lot of biologists look at microarray. You have a gene that you're interested in. You have a pathway that you like Notch or Hedgehog or something like that. And so you'll take a bunch of GBMs, throw them all together and say, let's see if Hedgehog is upregulated in this population. And you can find anything if you want to look for it. I'm just not sure how mathematically relevant it is. And so I'll give you an example. Here's some microarray data whereby we tried to bring this to some mathematical significance by looking at a significant fold change. So we looked at greater than two-fold change in a gene population of comparing. This is CD133 positive cells from normal human neural stem cells that are CD133 positive compared to medulloblastoma stem cells, which are CD133 positive. And so we compared these two populations, hoping to somehow extract some genes that might be involved in tumorigenesis, assuming a hypothesis that medulloblastoma stem cells may arise from a normal human neural stem cell. And we found 436 genes at a significance of less than 0.001 that we wanted to take a look at. And then you look at that list of genes, and you do these heat maps in these volcanoes, and I'm sure you're all familiar with them. You try to categorize the genes by function and find out which groups of genes, whether they may be metabolic or involved in cell signaling or involved in migration, try to figure out which genes are upregulated in which pools, and try to come to some meaningful type of analysis. But this is really an area where I'd like to talk to Mohammed and Siv a lot more about the best way to go about analyzing some of this data and to make sure that what we're extracting is actually biologically relevant. Another interesting thing is I told you a little bit more about a story that I'll probably tell you more about another time, but we're specifically looking at this epigenetic chromatin modifier in populations of our cancer stem cells. And we're finding an intriguing story there that has to do with fate determination. So again, just short to try to show you, a lot of us are trying to move towards an epigenetic regulatory model of some of our cancer stem cells. And really, what are we aiming for in the end? What's down the road? What we're hoping for is that in the end, here's a 5-year-old child with a medulloblastoma. We want to be able to profile each individual patient's brain tumor stem cell population, and ultimately our goal is to try to tailor molecular therapy to target cancer stem cells by some kind of unique marker expression, or perhaps, if not unique cell surface marker expression, some unique signaling pathway phenomenon, be able to provide some type of therapy in the long run that may target this population in particular. So I want to thank again Siv and Mohammed for inviting me here today, and thank you for your attention.